The Chinese built one of the oldest civilizations in history and lived as a closed society for hundreds of years, stubbornly defending their traditions and culture. In the 19th century, however, China began to open its doors to the outside world. It was the Europeans who came through those doors, particularly the British. The Europeans came to China for commercial reasons and began bringing their own culture to the country. Alongside Western culture, Western ideas also arrived. One of these ideas was Darwin's theory of evolution. In 1895, 36 years after its publication, Darwin's The Origin of Species was translated into Chinese and in a short space of time became very popular among the country's intellectuals. Books by other evolutionary theoreticians who supported Darwin's views also began to spread through the country. These included Thomas Huxley, considered Darwin's most fervent supporter, and for that reason known as Darwin's Bulldog. Darwin's cousin, Francis Galton, the founder of the theory of eugenics and a prominent racist. The social Darwinist, Herbert Spencer, who applied Darwin's theory of evolution to the social sciences. The common feature of these thinkers was their belief that man and all living things were in a constant state of conflict and that it was this which allowed them to evolve. They denied creation, saying that man had emerged by chance and portraying him as a species of animal with no divine responsibility. The spread of Darwinist thought through society in this way led to social turmoil, unrest, and conflict in China, just as it did in other countries. Darwinism had such an enormous effect in China in the 20th century that the Harvard University historian James Reeve Pusey wrote a book on that very issue, China and Charles Darwin. According to Pusey's account, Darwinism had a profound effect on Chinese intellectuals, encouraged them to adopt a revolutionary worldview, and provided major ideological support for the development of the communist movement in the country. The man who directed the course of the change that began with Darwinism was Mao Zedong. Mao's political ideology took shape during his student years in the early 1920s. His greatest inspiration was Chiang Dixiu, the general secretary of the Communist Party whom he met in Shanghai. Dixiu's principal characteristic was his devotion to Darwinism. He taught Mao both Marxism and Darwinism. In his memoirs, written years later, Mao said, "Nobody influenced me as much as Chiang Dixiu." The young Mao quickly came to prominence with the Communist Party, assuming the leadership from the second half of the 1920s. Communist guerrillas led by Mao began a long war against the central government led by Chiang Kai-shek, who had also been influenced by Darwinism. The difference between them was that Mao was a communist and Chiang Kai-shek a fascist. During the Second World War, Mao's and Chiang Kai-shek's forces formed a temporary alliance to fight the Japanese occupation, but began fighting each other again as soon as the war was over. During the conflict between the two Darwinist ideologies, hundreds of thousands of innocent people were killed. The Communist Party flag that was raised over the walls of Beijing represented an even darker time for the people of China, a land that was already in chaos. Mao's rule opened with a huge display. Crowds gathered under the red flags in Tiananmen Square applauded communism. Mao then set out the promises of communism in his frightening, high-pitched voice. Yet most of those who so happily cheered Mao were soon to become the victims of his savagery. In the first years of the communist regime, China's most important supporter was the Soviet Union. Stalin, the bloody dictator in Moscow, regarded Mao as both an ally and a personal friend. Mao now took his place alongside Stalin at the latter's show rallies. The first bloody cooperation between the two communist dictators came just after Mao's revolution, in Korea in 1950. Acting with Chinese and Soviet support, Communist North Korea suddenly attacked the occupied South Korea. United Nations forces were sent in to balance the situation, although the war lasted for 3 years and cost the lives of more than 3 million people. The Red Chinese Army directly entered the war on the side of North Korea, while the Soviets provided arms and equipment. Turkish units that fought in the Korean War on the United Nations side lost more than 700 men. After the Korean War, one of the bloodiest conflicts in history, Mao became more involved in internal Chinese affairs. He frequently addressed the people, and millions of Chinese were made to listen to his speeches over loudspeakers. He would promise industrialization and regeneration in those addresses and say Marxism-Leninism is our only guide. Like his comrade Stalin, Mao wished to implement a ruthless collectivization program. His first action was to confiscate private property. Propaganda films portrayed the happiness this measure would allegedly bring to the Chinese people. Businessmen whose assets had been seized put on false displays of joy. Women also appeared in the same false images of happiness. In reality, however, the regime brought people fear, not joy. Hundreds of thousands of people were tried in the People's Court set up in Mao's first years in power and condemned to death for minor crimes. The real disaster, however, would begin with Mao's great leap forward. When Mao came to power, the majority of the population were living in poverty, working in harsh conditions in the rice fields, and barely producing enough to feed themselves. But at least they did have enough to eat. The economic program known as the Great Leap Forward, begun by Mao in 1958, led China to complete disaster. The Great Leap Forward began with the slogan of doubling China's industrial and agricultural production. Propaganda posters explained how jealous Western countries would be of Chinese produce. Mao was portrayed as a leader who would solve all problems by implementing communist ideology in society. To that end, agriculture was first collectivized. Individual production was banned. Villagers were placed in huge communes consisting of thousands of people and forced to engage in collective production under military discipline. Mao would frequently visit the fields and inspect the villagers. At the same time, the Communist Party initiated a campaign aimed at ridding the whole country of harmful animals. Sparrows headed the list of animals thought to damage produce. Hundreds of thousands of Chinese set about exterminating them with catapults, stones, and guns. Those bringing in large numbers of dead sparrows were praised as model communists. Yet this odd campaign led to a result that the Communist Party had failed to foresee. The reduction of the sparrow population to zero levels led to a huge rise in the insect population, which the sparrows had formerly fed on. These insects caused much more harm to the country's produce. In 1958, competitions were held between communes. The amount of produce from each commune was measured. and those that produced most were held up as examples. Every commune swore to reach higher quotas. At the following harvest, they announced that they had all exceeded their quotas. But the statistics were false. Communes resorted to deception in order to give the impression that they had produced more. Some even tried to demonstrate that they had filled their quotas by replanting harvested crops in the inspection fields. The communal system led to false statistics, which in turn gave rise to an even greater error. The Communist Party declared that China had a larger stock of rice and grain than it needed, and that in the future it would have to give the priority to other tasks. Tens of millions of peasants were therefore removed from the fields and set to work on the construction of a giant canal. These villagers were portrayed in propaganda films as happy and highly motivated, although in fact, they were soon to suffer a terrible moral and physical collapse. Tens of thousands of people died as a result of industrial accidents in the hazardous conditions they were made to work in. The Communist Party came up with a crude calculation that every worker will build 1 meter of canal and the project will end in 3 months. Yet it actually took more than 10 years to finish the canal. During the Great Leap Forward, factory workers' hours were doubled, and machines began to work non-stop. They were not even allowed to stop for maintenance and repairs, and so soon began to fall apart. Factories were ruined. At the same time, Mao announced another target for the Great Leap Forward. Steel production was to be doubled within 1 year. That production was to come not only from heavy industry complexes, but also from small furnaces and villages. As a result of communist ideology, Mao believed that workers' power held a magical force. With that decision, tens of millions of Chinese set out to produce steel by amateur methods. Everything made of iron they could find, from doorknobs to saucepans, was melted down in primitive furnaces in an effort to produce steel. Women cut off their hair and mixed it with the clay in the furnaces. Forests were plundered to provide enough wood for these primitive ovens. People living in the cities, even doctors for instance, joined in the steel production, regarded as a national obligation, outside normal working hours. Yet the whole campaign was totally irrational. The Chinese were simply producing steel, but not making anything useful out of it. What is more, the steel produced was of such poor quality that it served absolutely no purpose. The true dimensions of the catastrophe emerged in 1959. While villagers were working on making steel or building canals, the fields were left empty. Falsified figures showed huge production, although there was actually a great production gap. A massive famine started within a few months. The situation was worsened by a severe drought. In 1960, the worst famine in the history of mankind erupted. ¥40 million people starved to death in just 2 years. Mao's great leap forward had ended in catastrophe. We have seen throughout this film what a ruthless and cruel system communism truly is. Another fact that needs to be made clear is the unintelligent thinking and behavior of communist regimes. The so-called reconstruction project that Mao called his Great Leap Forward is a clear example of this. The Great Leap Forward shows the clichés of communist ideology bear no relation to the real world, and that the great ideas of communist theoreticians such as Marx, Lenin, and Mao, supposedly so scientific and clever, are in fact nothing more than empty nonsense. Communists believed in a mistaken ideology and inflicted terrible suffering on mankind by trying to impose that ideology on society. The irrational system established by communism is also a living manifestation of God's description of the deniers in the Quran as people who do not use their intellect. The senseless policies of the Communist Party were not the only reason for the famine during the Great Leap Forward. Mao and his supporters also regarded famine as a method of punishment. The regions worst affected by the famine were those cities and villagers regarded as not being sufficiently obedient to the communist regime. The party seized all the produce in such areas, and just as in Stalin's Russia, hid it in warehouses while deliberately leaving the villagers to starve. The reason the Chinese communists were able to be so ruthless was the result of the way they regarded man. Just like Lenin and Stalin, Mao regarded human beings as a species of animal and attached no value to them. That was a natural consequence of the Darwinism he had imbibed in his youth. When he said, "The basis of Chinese socialism rests on Darwin and his theory of evolution," Mao was actually clarifying the basis of the savagery he implemented. Mao's Darwinist philosophy has been described by the Harvard University historian James Reeves Pusey in these terms: "The thought of Mao Zedong was and remains a powerful mixture of Darwinian ironies and contradictions. Mao Zedong, in an angry moment, as late as 1964, swore that all demons shall be annihilated. He dehumanized his enemies, partly in traditional hyperbole, partly in social Darwinian realism. Like the anarchists, he saw reactionaries as evolutionary throwbacks, who deserved extinction. The people's enemies were non-people, and they did not deserve to be treated as people." The Muslim Uyghur Turks of East Turkestan headed the list of those who suffered Mao's cruelty. With its long-term policy of genocide in East Turkestan, the communist regime ruthlessly slaughtered millions of innocent people. As a result of the nuclear tests deliberately carried out in the region, tens of thousands of children were left handicapped. This policy of genocide, that has been identified by international organizations, is still going on today in all its ruthlessness. Following the disaster of the Great Leap Forward, Mao withdrew from the scene and went into a kind of seclusion. The running of the country was left to more moderate civil servants. The Chinese were able, in part, to return to normal life and have a sigh of relief. But Mao was planning new murders. He thought that communist ideology had not spread sufficiently in society and attributed the failure of the Great Leap Forward to that deficiency. Mao's supporters printed tens of millions of copies of his Little Red Book, consisting of some of his speeches. Known as the Great Helmsman, Mao re-emerged onto the scene in the second half of the 1960s. A display of swimming he gave in the Yangtze River demonstrated both his energy and his support. Mao, first of all, set about debasing classic Chinese arts for the ideological program he dreamed of. He wished to graft the ideas of violence and conflict, the basis of communism, onto society, and thought he could commence the process with opera. Traces of communist insanity could clearly be seen on the faces of the performers, who had been brainwashed by Maoist doctrines. A visit by Mao to the opera was the greatest honor imaginable for such fanatical supporters. Mao commenced his second leap in 1966. This was the great proletarian cultural revolution. Propaganda portraying Mao as a divine figure was put out all over China. School children were made to learn his little red book off by heart. His slogans were written on walls. And posters portrayed him as literally a superhuman being. The militants of the Cultural Revolution were young students known as Red Guards. On August 18, 1966, some 1 million Red Guards, brainwashed with Mao's ideas, came together in Tiananmen Square. They trampled each other in an effort to catch a glimpse of Mao's face. One young girl student was brought to Mao's side and shook his hand. Even if that was of little significance to Mao himself, it was a matter of the greatest significance to the girl and her friends, who all fell over themselves to touch the hand that had been shaken by Mao. Mao set these brainwashed youngsters on society with the slogan, "Revolution is right." He ordered the Red Guards to humiliate teachers in schools, managers in state offices, or anyone else they saw as being in authority. Red Guards even detained Liu Shaoqi, who bore the title of head of state, and inflicted all kinds of insults on him. Anyone involved in the management of any institution was accused of not being a communist, even if he had done nothing wrong, and would be hauled up in front of the crowds and humiliated. Such people would have humiliating paper hats put on their heads, and labels with insults written on them hung around their necks, would be slapped and pushed, and even beaten and tortured. Most were then killed in mass executions. The Red Guards were even capable of humiliating and beating their own parents. They would stop passers-by and ask them about passages from Mao's little red book, beating those who failed to answer correctly. More than 1 million people were killed in this way. This is how one observer described the inhuman treatment meted out to university professors detained during the Cultural Revolution. Before a new four-story classroom building, I saw rows of teachers, about 40 or 50 in all, with black ink poured over their heads and faces. They all wore dunce caps and carried dirty brooms, shoes, and dusters on their backs. Hanging from their necks were pails filled with rocks. Finally, they all knelt down, burned incense, and begged Mao Zedong to pardon their crimes. Beating and torture followed. I had never seen such tortures before. Eating night soil and insects, being subjected to electric shocks, being forced to kneel on broken glass, being hanged like an aeroplane by the arms and legs. The Red Guards also attacked Western diplomats. The country was being drawn ever deeper into chaos and violence. Museums were ruined, books burned, after which fighting broke out between rival Red Guard factions. Factories, schools, and hospitals all stopped functioning. Mao's nonsense had led a whole country to a state of anarchy. Order was only restored when the army intervened. The Red Guards were made harmless and sent off to labor in the fields. Even so, the madness of the Cultural Revolution only came to an end with Mao's death in 1976. The Communist Party's loyalty to him continued, however. In the funeral lament written for him, the bloody dictator was portrayed as a superior being. Mao's body was mummified and preserved. His ideology would survive, however, and continue to spill blood. Maoism is the very worst version of communism. The interesting thing is that this tragedy struck not only China, but also other countries influenced by China. When Sino-Soviet relations fell apart in the 1960s, Maoism found support in various countries as an alternative model of communism. Regimes based on Maoist principles were set up in Albania, North Korea, and Cambodia. And those regimes inflicted almost unimaginable suffering on people. The Cambodian killing fields in particular are a tale of a savagery unequaled in world history. Cambodia, a small and impoverished Asian nation, first began to feel the cold breath of communism in the 1960s. At that time, North Vietnamese units at war with the United States had begun to cross the border and infiltrate into Cambodia. In the 1970s, the country was drawn into civil conflict. Cambodian communist guerrillas known as the Khmer Rouge began a bloody war against the central government. The hatred in their hearts could be seen in their faces. The Khmer Rouge were led by a Maoist called Pol Pot and came to power in 1975 when they entered the capital, Phnom Penh. The Khmer Rouge revolution saw the dawn of appalling terror. Thousands of state employees were killed on the streets, and the streets were filled with patrolling tanks. The Khmer Rouge set out with Mao's slogan, "The way of communism is peasantry," and forced the entire population out of the cities and into the villages. The capital, Phnom Penh, was emptied out within a few days under the threats of armed militants, and hundreds of thousands of people were sent off to the rice fields to suffer and starve. Those fields turned into terrible killing fields, where people were worked to death for a handful of food or executed for no reason at all. The minority Muslim population in Cambodia was a target for the savagery. The Khmer Rouge administration rounded up copies of the Quran and burned them, tore down mosques, and killed some 10,000 Muslims, women and children included. The communist regime not only attempted to destroy religion, but also the family. The communal form of living was established, and all families were split up. Children in the communes were indoctrinated with the idea that families were unnecessary, and were taught to love the Communist Party instead. These policies were nothing but Marx and Engels' comments on the origin of the family put into practice. Marx and Engels had suggested that man, whom they regarded as a species of animal evolved from apes, had no need of such concepts as religion, morality, or the family. The killing fields of the Khmer Rouge were set up in order to translate that superstition of Marx and Engels into life. In the killing fields, the guards could kill anyone they had the slightest suspicion of. Khmer Rouge killings were at first carried out by means of a bullet in the head. Later, in order to avoid wasting bullets, they began putting plastic bags over people's heads and suffocating them. 3 million out of the country's 9 million population were killed in that way. Today, the skulls and bones of those murdered by the Khmer Rouge are on display in a museum in Phnom Penh. One can see the deep fear in the faces of those whom the Khmer Rouge photographed before they killed. That is what communism and materialist philosophy have inflicted on mankind. All ideologies that reject God turn their backs on the morality He has taught and regard the world as one giant battleground, all inflict disasters on mankind in the same manner. God reveals the secret of this truth in a verse of the Quran. Corruption has appeared in both land and sea because of what people's own hands have brought about, so that they may taste something of what they have done, so that hopefully they will turn back. Communism reached its peak in the 1960s. The Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc were run by the communist regime in Moscow. In China, Mao had been deified and his ideology was portrayed as an infallible guide. Fidel Castro's regime ruled in Cuba. The communist guerrilla leader Che Guevara was attempting to organize guerrilla wars in the Congo and Bolivia. Many other countries in Africa, Latin America, and Asia were under the threat of communist terrorist organizations or communist regimes. During those years, communism also burst onto the scene in a totally unexpected place. Marxist ideology began to spread rapidly among young people in the West. The Marxist thinker Herbert Marcuse played an important role in that phenomenon. Marcuse offered a new definition of the revolutionary class, described as the workers by Lenin and as the peasants by Mao, the young. That same Marcuse actually agreed with Lenin and Mao on one fundamental matter. That was the Darwinist dogma that conflict was the fundamental law of nature. Marcuse's belief in conflict turned the 68 generation out onto the streets. Young British people held protest rallies at which they shouted slogans in support of North Vietnamese leader Ho Chi Minh. In Italy, leftist groups carried out acts of terrorism. The greatest explosion of violence in 1968 was in France. Firstly, Marxist students in Paris occupied their universities, and socialist slogans were shouted during the celebrations. Events began to grow when other leftist groups organized marches in support of the students. Marxist students tore cars apart and smashed streets and shops. In a matter of a few days, Paris turned into a war zone. The barbarity that marched under the red flag was only suppressed months later. The 1968 student incidents spread to many other countries under a kind of domino effect, and each time they led to social conflict, acts of terrorism, and even civil war. Those young people, exasperated by the political and economic problems of their day, believed that communism offered a solution. There was another important reason why the 68 generation got caught up in communist ideology. The education system that produced those young people gave them every detail of the basic philosophical training necessary for them to become communists. That was because Darwin's theory of evolution, which contains the basis of natural history for communism, as Karl Marx put it, was taught in schools as if it were a proven scientific fact. Young people who believed in Darwin's ideas that man was an animal that progressed through conflict were not slow to turn to terror and anarchy. We may recall that Darwin's theory of evolution prepared the ground for the development of Chinese communism, and that Mao's bloody regime arose from the ideological foundation of Darwinism. The entire picture reveals to us one very important fact. Communist ideology is the result of a worldview that regards man as a species of animal and believes that he progresses through conflict. If that worldview becomes prevalent in society, communism will inevitably ensue. When it finds an appropriate political and social climate, communism reorganizes itself and again begins shedding blood. The fact that the communist regimes in the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc were overthrown must not be allowed to put us off our guard. Communism is still a threat to the world because the ideology's basic philosophy is still alive and well. As long as that basis, in other words, Darwinism and materialism, is still alive, communism will continue to represent a grave menace to mankind. That being the case, the solution lies in doing away with that philosophical foundation. Darwinism and materialist philosophy, in any case, possess no scientific basis and must no longer be imposed on society as if they were true. People must understand that they are not animals who merely exist to fight with one another, but that they are honorable creatures who must live by the lights of that morality created and revealed by God. Once that truth has been grasped, both communism and the other ideologies that have brought disaster to mankind will disappear, and man will live in peace, security, and brotherhood.